I'm Isabella Granick, and we are having some discussions, a series of discussions with Brian Kam on different aspects of what he's been thinking about and working on and writing about and so on. And so I have asked him to have these sort of public discussions about these ideas because I'm deeply interested, but also only learning myself about some of these really important concepts. And so right now we've already done one discussion that we will link to that started to talk about Buddhist ideas of causality and dependent origination. And now we're back to think about this paper by Cleland that dives also deeply into different notions of causality in science and different types of sciences. And I am going to want to ask you a lot about how that relates to what you've already discussed with us last week around dependent origination. So maybe I'd love to hear from you, first of all, how you understand Cleland's main thesis, and then let's dive into the implications.
Yeah, so Cleland distinguishes between two different types of reasoning in the sciences, and one is related to the experimental sciences, or it's more primarily associated with that field. So things like physics and chemistry experiments that can be repeated. The other sciences that she discusses are historical, which means that they tend to give more narrative accounts of things that have happened in the past. And so they use a different type of reasoning as well. And she distinguishes between sort of, I think she means makes a clean distinction between the experimental sciences on the one hand and the historical sciences on the other hand. And then she tries to describe two methods of reasoning. And it's not as clean cut when it comes to those two methods, as in it's not the case that only physicists reason in one, you know, they only reason in one way, whereas geologists reason in this opposite way. But there is a difference in emphasis, and she tries to draw this into an issue in the asymmetry of causation, like at times hard to follow. But is that what you got out of this paper as
yeah.
well?
Yeah, that's certainly the overview that I was looking for, just to get everybody on the same page. And the question, I think, around these different ways of thinking about causality has something to do with, historically, the kinds of questions these two types of sciences are asking, and also how they think about and how time itself has an impact on the phenomena they are studying, right? And so when you just talked about this asymmetry, it's really about time, right?
Yes, exactly. So, and we can get into that. I mean, should we spend a little time on, the kind of example she gives of which kinds of questions fall under
absolutely.
Each? Okay. Yeah, and I think she does that a little bit better in the 4-page version because, just as background, I linked yesterday to a paper that I thought was the one that I had read. And in fact, basically, I came across these papers in 2020 when I was taking a online class called Paleo School. I think it was in one of the lockdowns, and it was basically an introduction to paleontology, which I knew nothing about. And this was one of the philosophy of science papers assigned to kind of understand what is paleontology and how does it relate to other sciences, because paleontology kind of both involves aspects of geology as well as archaeology as well as history, and it's kind of like a combination of all these things. And so they wanted to like think about how do we reason. And in just to briefly say, like, paleontology often is dependent on incredibly minor traces. So there are whole, you know, like species that we only know about through like a single tooth and things like that. And then we can extrapolate a huge amount of information from that one tooth. And we can say, okay, we know this, you know, had to be related to this. And it means that they were this size of this and, you know, all these other things. And And that's all without like DNA evidence, because DNA doesn't really last all that long. In other words, I'm sure there are other, you know, aspects of astronomy or other sciences that have to reason with extremely sparse information. But in a way, you can already see how this is very different from what we think of when we think of a physics experiment, where actually we've got the whole setup, we can run the experiment over and over again. We kind of have a great deal of control over what information surfaces and data collection and things like that. Whereas in something like paleontology or astronomy, we're kind of stuck with whatever happens to be out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so this results in Cleland's view, in very different ways of dealing with the evidence that's either available out there to collect or possible to produce in the case of the experimental sciences.
Right. And she really is trying to make the case for or fighting against those in the quote unquote hard sciences or experimental scientists who talk about their way of doing science through experimental manipulations as the way, the only way to test or find any kind of quote unquote truth out there in reality. And she uses in both papers this quote from Henry Gee, who's a Nature editor, and he says, you know, most boldly about the status of all hypotheses about the remote past. He says they can never be tested by experiment, and so they are unscientific. No science can ever be historical. That's a pretty bold claim.
Right.
So, and what eliminates,
you know, I mean, and she also mentions that, you know, there's been statements against Darwinism and things like that because of this understanding that it can't be, really be tested in a lab, right?
Yes.
And so G's kind of position is just the most extreme form of this, which is to say that if it can't be tested through experiment, then it doesn't count as science, which is,
right.
Yeah, quite a claim, right?
It's quite a claim, but I think even now there are many people in the sciences who would say that something like, using history is a methodology, but it is not a scientific one. And they may even give it its due, but certainly argue that that's just not in the toolbox of science, the sorts of methods that they use. So I think it's worth diving into the precise designs of these scientific explorations and hypothesis testing to really understand what the differences are and also where those fuzzy boundaries are.
Right. And maybe it's worth just saying the kind of archetypal issues that, the questions that Cleland raises, or examples, right? So one is the kind of, actually in the 4-page example, she gives a toy example. Can you remember what it is?
No, not off the bat, but I could look it up because, you know, the ones that she uses from geology and planetary things are things like the Big Bang, right?
Yes.
And I don't remember actually the scientific one or the experimental one.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because she kind of brushes over these, but you can imagine a chemistry experiment or something that's supposed to be easily repeatable, whereas she contrasts that with the example of the extinction of the dinosaurs and
right.
The Big Bang, right? Which are examples that she goes into in some detail to look at how do we reason about these things when the evidence is so sparse, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's where I think it's the devil is in the details in terms of, on the one hand, experimentalists becoming pretty elitist around how they think about hypothesis testing until you look deeper into the actual, experimental designs and science at work in the real lab. And then you see how many times they go against their very assumptions that are critical for criticizing the historical sciences. So for example, this idea that you can control for all extraneous context, and you must control for all extraneous context except for your manipulated variable in an experimental design. And of course, in history, you can't change anything. You're just using observation and other evidence around there. So these assumptions are entirely different in terms of what makes for support for a hypothesis, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I found it really fascinating that she talks about, you know, in certain cases, astronomical ones in particular, you, of course, don't get to ever control the universe. And so you don't get to run experiments. But with if the phenomena is sufficiently common, then reasoning starts to look a little bit more like the experimental sciences. So if you think of, you know, I think she gives some example of variable stars. I can't remember the exact wording, but they're frequent enough that you can kind of see them at different stages of their life. And so even though you can't run an experiment, you can reason like an experimentalist because there's these common examples, right? And so it's kind of like a spectrum between the two types.
Right. And so can you tell us in the most simple terms, let's say, how the scientific methods of experimental versus historical sciences relate to reasoning in how we think of in terms of logic and assumptions and so on?
Yeah, so I think the experimental way of reasoning is what we might think of it, it's forward causal reasoning, right?
We're
reasoning from causes to effects, right? And so we're looking at, you know, we control this specific situation and we're trying to move from the specific examples where we run an experiment and then run it again and run it again and hopefully get some other people to run it. And then we move from those specific instances to a general law, right? Or at least that's what physics does. And of course, we'll probably get into a discussion of physics envy and whether, you know, whether this kind of behavior is a, you know, something you can expect outside of very limited number of cases, basically. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I think it's important to emphasize, one, it goes from cause to effect, and two, it goes from the specific to the general. And she makes both of these points. She doesn't quite draw it out all, you know, she doesn't list those two super clearly right next to each other, but I think it comes through in the essay that these are two effects. And so then to contrast to that to the way of historical reasoning proceeds from effects to causes, right? You have to infer unseen causes. And it also proceeds, this is the part that I'm a little less certain about, but I was thinking about this today. Maybe it proceeds from like a general state of affairs to a specific narrative account. She certainly thinks that the specific narrative account, what she calls the smoking gun narrative, mm-hmm. where you basically generate competing plausible hypotheses and you try to differentiate them on the basis of available evidence. So in other words, the goal of the experimental sciences seems to be, going from specific cases to general laws. Whereas perhaps, and I'm uncertain about this and I would like to hear your thoughts.
Yeah.
For the historical sciences, you're kind of reasoning from a general state of affairs and trying to figure out how has this come about. And that usually involves a specific narrative. Is that how you understood the difference, or?
It's part of how I understand the difference. I think both end up using narrative quite strongly, and I think that's one of the reasons why we get into so much trouble and how they are so, in some ways, blurred. But even further than I think that the storytelling, I think what you're pointing to that's really important is one goes from an effect and goes backwards to find the cause, and the other starts from a cause or a hypothesized cause and goes forward to predict. And so one of the ways that I have thought about this quite a lot, which I think maps onto her description really well, is that evolutionary science, geology, etc., these are sciences for finding explanations for understanding the how and the why, whereas the harder science like physics and chemistry and so on is more about finding the prediction. So it's about predicting. It's about understanding. So, and you're right that it's from the specific to the general, because if we if our predictions are correct, if we understand a phenomenon in physics, then we are able to take a particular context and predict out to the future. Whereas the other is not the case at all. That's not what they're trying to do in the historical sciences.
Yeah, that's a great point, which is that the experimental sciences, yeah, are concerned with the future. So a third distinction that, you know, it is related to this point that they go from causes to effects, but on a larger scale, yeah, you're doing these experiments, controlling something in the present to try to produce an effect in the future.
Right.
Whereas with the historical sciences, you're looking at the state of the present and trying to infer what's happened in the past. And yeah, one question I had, because sometimes I think about, okay, there's two types of reasoning. Well, you know, the more obvious, you know, if you said that to someone, they would probably say, yeah, deduction and induction, and maybe there's this other thing, abduction. But I actually don't think this is the same distinction, but I'm not 100% sure. Do you have a view on this?
I agree that it's not exactly the same distinction. And I will tell you right now, I think I spent an hour trying to recreate which one's which and what's missing and how to map them on. So I think it's actually difficult because both are kind of doing sometimes the same thing. And so for me, I think what was really important is to think about, I'm trying to not get ahead of us and start talking about how you've introduced causality in the Buddhist sense, because there's something really important as a distinction to these ways of thinking. But I think I'm still nevertheless kind of influenced by that discussion we already had. And so taking it back, I think the idea of this asymmetry, I think they call it asymmetry of overdetermination in the article, is really important, that there's an asymmetry to a science that looks back and tries to find, in this kind of solving a mystery format, causes versus this looking forward. And I can see them as induction and deduction, but I also think that they're not perfectly matched onto that.
Yeah. That's kind of my feeling too, is that maybe the experimental sciences use more deduction, but I don't think it is the same distinction.
No.
The other thing is, yeah, so you mentioned the overdetermination and underdetermination. This is where I find it very hard to follow, actually.
Yeah.
So she's talking about David Lewis, and he has this idea of asymmetry of causation, right? And
right.
If I'll try and do it from memory. So the idea is that any given cause has multiple effects. It's not that it's guaranteed to, but it's just likely to fall that way, right? So
yes.
She gives the example that if you throw a baseball through the window, you know, that you can kind of consider that as one event, but then it has all these traces, as in different pieces of glass kind of go everywhere. And she's saying that events in the past are like this, and this is why you can actually do the kind of reasoning that, you know, we've talked about in terms of paleontology. You know, you can find this single bone and basically extrapolate a whole species or lineage or whatever it is out of that single trace. Whereas in the opposite direction, she's saying that it's like effects are underdetermined by causes or something like that. And so basically she's saying, you know, it's rare for multiple causes to have a single effect. Is that part of, like, this part I fail to grasp a little bit.
No, I think you've basically got it. And part of what I did as I was reading this, I was like, this is exactly where the sciences, the social sciences really, I think, falter in many ways, and psychology specifically. And I knew there was a Freud quote that I really wanted to get, and I found it. And I'd like to read it out because I think it kind of captures something important about this asymmetry. So it's beyond the pleasure principle. And here's the quote. So long as we trace development from its final outcome backwards, the chain of events appears continuous and we feel we have gained an insight which is completely satisfactory or even exhaustive. But if we proceed the reverse way, if we start from the premises inferred from the analysis and try to follow these up to the final result, that is forward causality, then we no longer get the impression of an inevitable sequence of events which could not have been otherwise determined. We notice at once that there might have been another result and that we might have been just as well able to understand and explain the latter. Hence, the chain of causation can always be recognized with certainty if we follow the line of analysis, i.e. reconstruction, whereas to predict it is impossible. End quote. So I think that's basically what she's also talking about in the distinction. And here's where I think it's really interesting to think about how the sciences reason differently, because I think for Freud, we should be reasoning as historians or as geologists or evolutionary scientists. And yet what we have tried to do in psychology is try to go into this mechanistic physics-oriented way of examining the phenomena we're interested in. Does that make sense to you?
So you're saying that in Freud's time, psychology is more doing this kind of, it's treating it like a historical science, where
yes,
it's treating psychology as behaving like a historical science, whereas in the 20th century under B.F. Skinner and people like that, they attempted to emulate an experimental science. Is that
exactly so? And okay. I think that distinction is really interesting and important because it gives us a bit of a lens, or it's this microcosm of where things can go wrong when you take the wrong assumptions in your scientific view, and neither one of them are necessarily right or wrong, but that they give you very different ways of thinking about what you're examining.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I hadn't really thought about that, but I do think we should briefly touch on the physics envy aspect. I mean, yeah, I'm not sure I have a huge amount to say, except that what it brings up for me, and I don't have a huge amount of certainty on this point, you know, like what it makes me think about is, like, I guess you've got people like Comte and not Kant, but Comte, C-O-M-T-E, and people like that kind of leading on to this logical positivism thing. And I think the eventual hope of positivism was that things would turn out more like physics, and that basically, you know, this scientific method was pretty general, that there was one, that it was going to be able to solve all problems. And there kind of are still some people that are in this camp. But largely, you know, the commonplace is that kind of falls down around the time of Thomas Kuhn, who doesn't really directly attack it, but attacks its kind of auxiliaries. Although I also think that is an oversimplified history of what was going on in positivism and what it hoped to achieve and why. But I do think that's like the kind of dominant understanding. So, you know, up till, let's say, 1950, 1960, there's this understanding that, and even in Kuhn, it's palpable, right? That he has this idea that, well, maybe the sciences that don't have this kind of consensus and certainty are just pre-paradigmatic, and that eventually they're going to wind up looking like, you know, mathematics did in antiquity, and then astronomy did, you know, under Kepler or something like that, and then eventually, you know, physics under Newton or something. And that he even talks about, you know, will psychology or anthropology ever be like this? And of course, yeah, I suppose there are people in the early 20th century thinking that it will. I don't have like
absolutely
a huge amount of knowledge beyond that, but
yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And the reason why it's important, this issue, and I think you're intuiting it right, is that the physics envy is that there was and still is a implicit, if not explicit, assumption that the experimental way to do science is the right and only way. and everything else should not be regarded as science. And this is, I think, an important impasse, because those social sciences that wanted to, that still have extremely important questions to be asked and hypotheses that can be generated, by trying to emulate these other types of sciences, I think have gone deeply astray, because they cannot, there is no way for them to meet the assumptions of the physical sciences. There is no way, for example, to control for all variables except the one that you want to manipulate. Even in physics, we find that that's now starting to become impossible to think about in any kind of perfectly rigorous way. But certainly in something like psychology or sociology or history and so on, you can't do that kind of thing. And so rather than throw the baby with the bathwater, the other opportunity is to say there are these historical sciences that have incredibly useful methodologies, and those can be adapted and made more rigorous for us. But the idea isn't to go and jump ship and go into these mechanistic ways of looking at hypotheses and experimental designs.
Yeah, and it makes me think of another thing you sometimes hear about psychology, this idea that in the, you know, at the turn of the 20th century, it was sort of about three things. One being savants or geniuses, which of course Schopenhauer was really interested in. And apparently that was like a much more mainstream question. And then the second one, like happiness, flourishing, the eudaimonia kind of stuff. And then only the, you know, the third was psychopathologies. Whereas kind of by the end of the 20th century, the other two, you know, the question of genius and the question of happiness have kind of left psychology alone with just psychopathology. Do you think that has anything to do with what's, I don't know, is that just like an unrelated trend that's going
Absolutely
on?
Absolutely not unrelated, and we need another 10 hours. I had no idea that this was something that we can trace to Schopenhauer and talking about, because the big thing in, you're absolutely right, that for a while we used to care in psychology, it's what totally got me into it, we used to care about normative development, that is, everyday people's experience of suffering and happiness and development and all the incredibly intricate and interesting things that happen in a person who doesn't necessarily have a clinical diagnosis. And the more we got into this kind of utilitarian science, where we needed to back up our examinations with, you know, the implications for the real world, these can't be just basic science questions we have about psychology, the more we ended up having to focus on depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, drugs and how they work on the brain, et cetera. And funding went that way, especially. And we've lost a lot of the excitement around those basic questions around human existence, human, you know, work and flourishing. Yeah.
And it occurs to me that, I suppose, that psychopathology may be more subject to experimentation and treatment, whereas happiness may be harder to experiment on or like run. I mean, I'm sure it is studied and everything, but you know what I mean? And, yes. And the genius question probably got tied up with eugenics and other things that were going on at the start of the 20th century that fell out of favor for sometimes.
But it's a great point. It's a great point, because if you can have something that feels very medical, like, oh, you have a diagnosis or not of depression or schizophrenia, and then we can put you in two groups, those that have this particular psychopathology and those that don't, as if these are perfectly controlled and perfectly clean, homogenous groups, and then compare them on certain variables, then we've got a clean experiment, right? And so I think the positive psychology movement came out of as a sort of rebellion against that total focus, myopic focus on psychopathology. And we have some people hoping to get back to thinking about how to integrate philosophy as well as living the good life in psychology.
So that's Martin Seligman kind of starting in the 1970s. Yeah, and quite interestingly, I mean, he has a massive reaction against Wittgenstein as well. We should probably have a conversation about that whole movement. Mm-hmm. At some point, because, you know, analytic philosophy is also kicking off at this same time, or this bifurcation between what's now called analytic philosophy and continental philosophy. It just occurred to me, and this is maybe something we can come back to later, you know, this Buddhist concept of papancha, or it's conceptual proliferation or mental proliferation. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about the DSM-4 or whatever, like, you know, the number of concepts that are getting sort of generated,
yes.
or the number of pathologies that are getting generated as an example of this kind of proliferation, you know?
It's fascinating that we keep coming back to this, right? Because we also talked about this the last time around rumination and positive versus negative rumination and how we can think about that. I wonder if this is a good segue to think, you just tell me, because we can obviously stay only with Cleland's ideas, but I did want to think about how you consider her ideas in relation to Buddhist causality. And I have a specific question that I wanted to see if it resonates at all with you. Can I try that?
Yeah, that sounds good. Yep.
Okay. So help me understand this. So both historical and experimental scientists seem to rely on this kind of preconceived concepts to examine their phenomena. So to know what to look for, they have to have already had a conceptual framework for such things, right? But many of the most compelling questions, I think anyway, in science, including things like, you know, where does the earth come from, or the nature of consciousness, or, you know, the nature of suffering, et cetera, whether there's like other living beings in the cosmos, et cetera, all of these questions kind of require lenses that we haven't necessarily built yet, or maybe they do. And it seems to me that both the historical and the experimental scientists can't even do their work, whether they're working backwards or forwards, without very tightly constrained conceptual frameworks. And of course, that's where the hypotheses emerge from. And there's something about how you discuss Buddhist ideas of dependent origination and causality as this emergent, immediate thing that happens from various vectors that seems important to think about in this context. Does that make sense?
So is the question like, how do concepts get generated in the first place?
Yes, and to what degree? So I definitely want to ask, how do concepts get generated in the first place? And then if we understand that, it seems to me that that has a huge impact on thinking about how these scientists function in both these domains.
Yeah. So the first one is obviously a big question.
Yeah. And
it's actually not one that I have a good answer to, I don't think. You know, I'm working on this idea that the Buddha, you know, by constantly returning to sensations and allowing concepts to arise but not becoming attached to them, then you get to see how they form. And I have this idea, you know, that I've talked about before, that Darwin is doing a similar thing when he goes in with, mm-hmm. you know, armed with these categories of species and varieties in The Origin of Species, and then, you know, spends 8 years looking at barnacles, and everyone's like, what is he doing in that period? And I think he is doing a kind of Vipassana meditation where basically mm-hmm. it's a constant return to the evidence, right? Where over and over and over again, you don't become attached to the categories. I think he had to kind of drop those, and that, you know, that I don't really know what to say, except that a big chunk of the early part of The Origin of Species is about this question of, are there, if there's something called species that can't breed with each other, and there's something called a varieties, which, you know, which are different from each other somehow, but they can still breed with each other. Like, where does this line fall? And he just keeps trying in species after species to like pin the line down. And the more he does it, the more he doesn't want it to be artificially constructed, but he can't kind of like avoid seeing the sort of arbitrariness of it. And I think this doesn't really explain how concepts arise necessarily, but I think in order to to understand that question, you just have to do really a lot of it. And, yes. and what I mean by it is actually you have to pay attention to experience itself and to the evidence and to the how categorization seemingly intuitively happens in order to understand the how categorization works. And actually, it's I think it's very funny. This morning in Readwise, this quote came up from Eric Havelock, who's writing about it's preface to Plato, I think, and it was very controversial at the time. He's trying to argue that the way Greek nouns work, like altered between, let's say, Homer and Plato. And of course, you know, he's not alone in, you know, Nietzsche and after him, Jaynes and McGilchrist and lots of other people pinpoint this transition, you know, in this few hundred years of between the Greeks. But I think there's something in it. And what was really striking, and this does relate to Cleland, is that he says what's going on in Homer is a loose collection of individual stories whose whole is greater than the parts. Whereas in Plato, there's the whole, like basically the parts only exist, the kind of smaller ideas, in order as subordinates in a hierarchy to produce a greater whole. And so there's a kind of almost opposite relationship between them. So in other words, in Homer, you've got this specificity, and then the specificity of it leads to a greater whole. Whereas in Plato, the interest is in the whole. And, you know, it comes out most explicitly in Socrates, where he's only interested in concepts, right? If I say, you know, if I say, he'll say things like, what is piety? And then, you know, you might respond to him, well, piety is when I do this or that. And he would just say, like, I'm not interested in your specific examples. I'm asking about the general concept.
Right.
And so, you know, this is precisely the opposite of what the Buddha is saying. And I do think it relates to the difference between the historical and the historical and the experimental sciences, because as we said at the beginning, the historical sciences are moving they're moving towards the specific, right?
Yes.
Whereas the experimental sciences are moving toward the general, right? And so it's almost like you could argue that that Socrates is already doing something that's going to lead on into experimental sciences, whereas the Buddha is doing something that's going to lead into a kind of historicization or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, I completely get what you're saying, and I think it's very exciting, and I think there's a couple of places we can follow up on this, because first of all, it seems to me then, and I wonder if Sam Biagetti is listening right now, it seems to me that there then does become an argument for the, I guess, honesty or integrity of the historical way of doing science above and beyond the experimental designs, because there are so many ways that, for lack of a better word, people cheat in the experimental designs, not on purpose necessarily, but I mean that they the kinds of generalizations they make from the specifics are not necessarily true to the data, right? Or the manipulation. And so I think this, and I think that means it's partially because they are trying to do their very best to separate from subjectivity. They are trying to be as quote unquote objective and clean in their experimental results and the experimental design. And as a result, experience and observations of experience are absolutely outside the purview of experimental approaches to science. And I think part of what you're saying is people like Darwin, and I would say people maybe like Humboldt and I don't know, even Goethe, in the way that they talked about how closely they observed the scientific phenomena they were interested in and kept rethinking their categories, I think is really, really important. Your point around the the importance of what Darwin was doing, and I was adding like people like Humboldt and Goethe, when they were, their powers of observation or their, the import they gave to extremely open and meticulous observation is such an important one. It was a practice, and the ability to stay open without fixed hypotheses, which to me is almost the same, categorizations, concepts, and those sorts of things, to me are the same as sticking with a preconceived hypothesis before having gathered enough data that you sort of understand the space of possibilities before you start the actual hypothesis testing, which by its nature constrains and forces us to think or see only certain phenomena to the exclusion of others.
Yeah, and this is something Kuhn talks about a lot, right? The kind of the paradigm affects your view of the world, and only sort of people who live through the paradigm shifts can actually sort of come to understand how perception changes as a result, you know, and that questions that seemed solved become open, and some questions, you know, which were once scientific become metaphysical, and, you know, it affects what you see. And I think that's why at some point Althusser is going to become really important, in the understanding of how ideology, as he puts it, but really it's, you know, worldview, something like that, which I think starts in Kant, and Carl Jaspers is doing something with it. Worldview is like an important one in that I do want to get into eventually. And I feel like it relates to Kuhn's paradigms, I'd be curious to know whether you think it relates to Piaget's schemes.
Absolutely. And I, you know, whether we do it later or now as a starting point, I think it's incredibly important. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the idea of obviousnesses that Althusser talks about. And because I think it directly relates to the question that I had when we springboarded to this part, which is that I feel like the historical and experimental scientists both are the same in that they have to necessarily rely on their preconceived frameworks. Whether they're looking backwards or forwards, they have a framework, and that constrains what they see. And it might be that some of the most important questions we still have unanswered and have been unanswered since science began its progress is because we continue to get locked into frameworks and concepts that do not allow us to see things outside anything novel. And I think the idea that you're talking about in terms of Buddhist practices of breaking that down and holding away from clinging to those concepts is super important. So yeah, maybe you can start with Althusser, because I do think it's important.
Yeah, so his, the work that I'm referring to is the only thing I've read of his, which is the 1970 Ideology and Ideological State Apparatuses. And I think he kind of starts with the question of, you know, we all understand what a repressive state apparatus is, you know, that where police force you to do something, but that's not typically how societies function, as in that can be a kind of measure of last resort. But in fact, there's lots of emergent processes that affect how we behave. And he goes through, you know, saying that it's not just official state, you know, sort of, you know, parts of the state that actually enforce social behavior. It's also people who emergently, kind of from the bottom up rather than the top down, try to assert certain kinds of norms. But one of the effects of this is that it produce, like any ideology, it any good ideology produces this effect that you don't know you're in ideology, even though basically everything is ideological in his view. And so, and I think this is related to the question that you're asking as well. I mean, the Buddhist point is the same one at a smaller scale, which is that in order for the self view to come about, a kind of identity view where you say, you did this to me, that story has to be kind of persuasive on some level. Like, and it's not just persuasive to someone else, it's also persuasive to you, and in such a way that it doesn't seem story-like, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't seem like a story you've generated. It seems like the truth, right?
Yes.
And I think this is what Althusser is talking about when he talks about obviousnesses. And he thinks that Marx had some insights into this, and that Spinoza, actually, interestingly, he talks about Spinozism. They're the only ones because, I don't want to get into that section, but the point is just that concepts affect how we think about something. And when we become aware that this has happened, our kind of knee-jerk thing is to like reverse them. I was talking to Nassos this weekend about, you know, if someone tells you that one brand is better than another, it's like hard to unsee that. And also, you know, like you might have a reaction and say, no, I think they're wrong, and kind of reverse this hierarchy or whatever, and say that you disagree with them. But what's hard is to go back to the state where you didn't have these categories in the first place, right?
Yes.
And the question, you know, probably comes up, which is like, why would you want to do this? And I think the answer is that when a narrative or conceptual framework or strategy ceases to work, then it's important to understand how. Like, it's kind of almost better not to know how it works if it's working well. And I think this is part of what Kuhn is saying with normal science, right? That during periods of scientific progress, science keeps philosophy at arm's length for good reason, because it actually would only impede the answering of questions that, you know, will be answered in by sticking to the current strategy, right? Mm-hmm. But then when there's a crisis about like, okay, our current strategies are no longer working, then people who are able to kind of see outside of this framework come to the fore. And he actually thinks that it's young people or people from outside the field that often end up in this role of, you know, being responsible for some kind of paradigm shift.
Yeah.
And so I think the point, I'm not sure if I'm being super clear, but the point between obviousnesses and worldviews and paradigms is that although they're extremely useful in organizing and directing action, when that action ceases to work, you need a way to remember that your view of everything is filtered. And this is I guess it's both a feature and a bug. It's not that there is some way of seeing without these, right? And that's, yes, Althusser's point. There is no way around ideology. Like the closest you can come is to become aware that you're in ideology. Whereas he, yes, says, anytime you deny that you're in ideology, then you're definitely in it,
basically. Absolutely. And here's the important reason why I am excited about your work and being able to help excavate that work and the implications for not only, you know, a general sort of a project that's really important, but also because I think young people today need to understand a little bit more about these obviousnesses, because it is all the more difficult to act in a sort of layered world of AI and a layered world of assumptions that you aren't taught how to, you're not taught even that they are there, never mind how to critically analyze them or think about them or practice in your own everyday life how to see to some degree through them. And I mean, this has been the case forever, Brave New World and so on. But I think the project of trying to develop a healthy, you know, a methodology for healthy inquiry is just that. It doesn't have to be another ideology that we propose and put forward, but a way of thinking about concepts and then our experience in the world according to those concepts and how they differ or not, that's really important to start measuring, thinking about, observing, and so on.
Yeah, and it does relate to this question. I don't have a strong view on this, but of course, you know, well, there's this idea of the singularity that goes back to John von Neumann in the 40s or whatever, saying he's kind of just saying, like, his point is a very general one, which is that, like, this, like, the rate of change can't keep accelerating in the way that it seems to be accelerating, or human life will certainly not remain the same as it was. It's like generally that open, as opposed to, you know, I think the word singularity has come to mean something else today, but just the point being that it does seem like these certainly technologies I don't want to make a strong point about how fast things are changing or if they are changing more quickly, but just to say that it does seem like individuals go through more changes in their life than they did 100 or 500 or 1,000 years ago, like within a single lifetime, in terms of having to kind of switch strategies, switch careers, switch, you know, everything they think is true. And so it may be adaptive on a personal level to learn about some of these things. And I don't know, there is something else I wanted to get to about just the Buddhist understanding. You know, I suppose it's just that, you know, in the Buddhist understanding, just to briefly summarize what we talked about last time.
Please.
Ignorance leads to a self-concept, which leads on to suffering, right? It leads to clinging to this kind of self-identity, which is a conceptual clinging, right? The point of suffering is not, he's not talking about primary pain. So I give the example of, like, you know, you stub your toe, there's pain. Then there's like the second order, I shouldn't have done that. And that's the part that the Buddha is saying is optional. But that second part is also like, it involves conceptual thinking, right? Mm-hmm. And it seems to be, it's kind of irresistible in a way. But what the Buddha shows is that, like, by examining how inferences work, you know, you can see that the pain arises, then the experience of pain arises, and then, you know, you infer someone that's caused the pain, and then you infer that you've done this to yourself. And it's like something in that conceptual, like, set of leaps that produces the second order suffering, right?
Yes.
And he's saying, you know, if you learn how inferences work on, like, a deep level, then this kind of suffering becomes optional. But I think the point is bigger, right? Which is that this relates to, like, historical reasoning, right? Which is that, you know, it's almost like, well, I mean, if you take Anil Seth or Carl Friston's point of view, and which ultimately derive, I think, from von Helmholtz, then every act of perception is inference on unseen causes, right? And it's applying conceptual frameworks to the mess of reality. Is it William James, the blooming, what is it? Blooming, buzzing, something.
Yes, exactly. That. I'm so glad you're going here. This is exactly where I thought I had wanted to take you when I was asking about frameworks in each of these approaches to science. It's exactly, so keep going.
Yeah, so I kind of don't know exactly where it's leading, except that, yeah, and this, in my head, that this stuff about Cleland's difference between the historical and experimental sciences is a sort of third installment, the first one being what we talked about last time about Buddhist understandings of causality versus conditionality. So forward causes, backwards conditions. And the way I've been thinking about it lately is, you know, there is this path dependent link by link story that produced, you know, that in which, you know, my parents met and I'm here, right? But of course, looked at backwards, you know, like the Freud quote, it seems like just this mess of contingencies and conditions,
exactly.
Right? Mm-hmm. So you can't, like, you certainly can't predict on that basis. And so it doesn't behave like an experimental science when you look at it that way. Instead, you see this kind of branching web that seems to get, like, more and more sort of infinite as you go backwards.
Yeah.
And I could, you know, I always cite this thing from Tolstoy about, you know, the further we get away from events in the past, the more inevitable they seem, not because they were inevitable, but because we cease to be able to, you know, maintain that counterfactual reality, mm-hmm, which at the mm-hmm. time is very open. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but 2 days from now will seem like, you know, that's just assumed, like that everything was sort of leading to that. So it leads to a kind of teleological rewriting. And I think that to some degree, all concepts do this, right? Nietzsche says all concepts equate the unequal. Mm. And the kind of bridge chapter between this Buddhist conditionality, causality, confusing thing that I've been banging on about for five, 6 months now, and this understanding of how history splits off from the experimental sciences, or rather how these two things tend to favor one type of reasoning, is Schopenhauer's distinction between intuition and reason. And I don't think we probably have time to get into that, but I do want to kind of talk about that one at some point, because I
absolutely
think his distinction between, you know, how perception is always immediate and always gives us a three-dimensional spatial intuitive sense of what's going on. It's always in the present,
yes,
as opposed to this kind of rational reasoning, which always proceeds serially, as it were. It has to happen over time. And mm-hmm. it's most evident in the written word. But to some degree, it's always the case, right? Even this conversation that we're having involves time. It involves like serially putting all these words, which have very general meanings, one after the other, and then having those translate back into some kind of spatial understanding. You know, if I'm going to say anything that has any consequence on your behavior, it's been translated from this immediate perceptive experiential, you know, immediate quality of my life, and then put into this linear, translated from three dimensions into one, is how Schopenhauer puts it, into language. And then on the receiving end, you know, if our conversation works, then you will decode it from this one dimensional space back into three, basically.
Right.
And I don't know, it does relate to Cleland's point, but I don't know how.
Well, I see certainly the alignment there and how it would relate, and that there has to be some digging in there. I also see, given that you've brought up Tolstoy, how important poetry is. I know this sounds like a complete non sequitur, but the idea that what poetry does at its best is a process of defamiliarization that you often talk about, right? And so, you know, any of our experience of really good poetry, it takes language and shifts the way that you usually perceive not just language, but phenomena. And so poets, if they're good poets, are observing in different ways. They're trying to break our concepts up. And, you know, if you read an Emily Dickinson poem 10 times over, the same poem, you'll see this incredible sort of spell that she casts with time and how much she puts you in the present moment and then switches it up, makes you think about history different, like your past and your own future differently in the moment that you're reading the poem itself over and over. And so I think that kind of spell casting collapses time in a very particular way with very good poetry, and does exactly what maybe some meditation practices also do, which is to break your obviousnesses in ways that help you see something different or more clearly.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. And I think, you know, poetry is, yeah, it makes the stone stony. Who is that? I can't remember. But I think there's a reason that Nietzsche and Heidegger both end up writing poetry, or maybe write poetry throughout. And there is something about it, like you said, the Shklovsky's idea of defamiliarization, which brings experience, it makes it new again, right?
Yes.
It makes the familiar unfamiliar. Whereas Nietzsche is saying that, you know, there's something kind of collapsing about prose. And I think it's important to distinguish dialogue or the written word from the spoken word, because Socrates, I actually want to do a thing on the difference, like, between what Socrates means by conversation to what Chuanzu means by illumination, because he also thinks that conversation is more important than the written word. It's, you know, famously Socrates kind of won't write anything down because he thinks that then it becomes fixed and then it becomes unresponsive or something like that. There's this thing about Thoth. And I don't know where I was going with that, but back to poetry. Yeah, I suppose poetry calls attention to words as words on some level. And as, you know, it does make them concrete somehow. And I think that's at the kind of opposite end of the spectrum from this Socratic move of piety or something. I mean, I'm speaking in huge generalities, of course, because I can think of all kinds of, you know, 18th century poems that are about, you know, black melancholy and, you know, these very abstract, you know, courage and piety and all these kind of things. So it's not like, but at the same time, there is something about meter and rhyme and poetry per se that calls attention to itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think the best of those earlier, you know, 18th century poems, even if they were talking about abstract concepts like piety, the entire point was to use metaphor to ground it in experience, right? So much of it was about thinking, what does this even mean? And having that kind of highlighted. It also then kind of goes into the more modernist position where, you know, people like William Carlos Williams would say things like, no ideas, but in things. Mm. So the poetry became absolutely, as far as I can, it didn't sound beautiful anymore. But yes, the point there in their experiments was to ground us in experience ever more, right? And to go away from that sort of flowery language so that we can think again about what language is doing for us. And I love that idea that it's not that one trend or another is particularly right, but the point is to shake it up constantly and to move from these extremes.
Yeah, and I think that point comes across, I was thinking about it earlier, you know, Nietzsche's idea about the kind of Apollonian and the Dionysian, and this idea that, you know, at the time that Plato's writing, maybe what's needed is a kind of shift towards abstraction because things are a little bit too, you know, Dionysian, that basically they're too disordered, you know. And I think it would be interesting to think about those two, you know, like the idea of order and chaos, or Apollonian and Dionysian, in this, in these frameworks, because of course, you know, of course, we've got these laws of physics that are all very clean and everything. I've wanted to do a piece that, you know, to say that, like, Occam's razor is just a German aesthetic preference or something. Even though Occam, I think, is English. I don't know. He's probably at University of Paris. But, like, so, in other words, saying that there are times when more abstraction is probably good, you know, like, and I think today we don't, today I think that the dominant failure mode is to get lost, to forget that you're looking at a map, to make maps of maps, to forget about the territory altogether. And, you know, not that maps have to be perfect or that they have to represent, you know, there's many different ways to make a map, and they can all be useful in different ways. But in general, being drawn back to the territory is, like, does seem to solve, it certainly it solved problems in my life. And I think, I think in general, that's like a more common failure mode. The way that I mean, there is this kind of opposite tendency of woo, which, and maybe psychedelics, like really, you know, serious whacks of psychedelics daily, you do get this kind of problem of a kind of like loss of tension or an inability to kind of abstract out of experience or something like that.
Absolutely.
Sometimes on meditation retreats, it happens a little bit too. And I've just seen that Sam has asked a question, which I don't think I'm smart enough to answer, which is, Can this distinction more or less map onto the distinction of nomothetic versus ideographic? And I don't know the answer to that, but I'm very excited to learn what these words
mean.
Yeah,
I do remember it. I mean, I'm not even going to attempt this because I think it's about image versus
names.
I would love to start a conversation. We have to do this where Sam can also talk with us. I think there is a lot to do with that. And I think we have talked a little bit about failure modes and where we think the right now there's more of an emphasis on this conceptual and so on. Again, I think the important, and maybe I'm steeped in McGilchrist right now reading his current tome, The Matter with Things. And I think it's
really
useful.
Yes, I've heard
about
that from two different people this week who are also reading it separately. Yeah. So yeah.
We have a reading group that's starting up next week for that. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Sam.
Hi. Yeah, I've just been listening. I've maybe been following 50 to 60%. but yeah, it's a wonderful conversation. And, you know, this is a thing people have to come up and talk about at some point in history, in history graduate education. But it's never really explored very thoroughly. But, one thing that they just sort of briefly threw at us early on, they gave us this book, Objectivity by Peter Novick. And it makes reference to this distinction that goes back to German 19th century philosophy, and was sort of laid out by Wilhelm Windelband, who was a neo-Kantian, whatever that means, that there's a sort of general distinction between nomothetic reasoning and ideographic, where nomothetic is the attempt to synthesize laws, and ideographic is kind of the opposite, or the reverse, I think you could say, of trying to distinguish specific phenomena from one another. So, rather than trying to reason about, say, the behavior of humans, instead trying to break down the category of humans and distinguish one from another. I think Windelband, he argued that these sort of two modes of reasoning are always coexist in any discipline and any pursuit. But people kind of, I think, took this distinction, which again is like a nice little binary distinction, and ran with it and used it to kind of argue that, well, history doesn't have to do science because we're doing the reverse. We're our form of knowledge production is ideographic, not nomothetic. Which is sort of appealingly simple in a way, but, again, it, like any binary, it sort of breaks down when you really try to do anything with it. So, I just wanted to kind of throw that in because I kept thinking of that as sort of this nice kind of prefabricated way of naming this distinction that maybe we're getting at.
Yeah, that's fascinating, Sam. And I hadn't heard of this distinction, but it does sound super related. So that's interesting. So science was, sorry, history was saying that it didn't need to, that it was kind of opposing itself to science. Is that right? Or
Correct.
Yeah.
So yeah, whereas science is, and this concept was cooked up, I think, in the late 19th century. And so a lot of, like Freud wasn't on the scene yet. It was a lot of social science kind of wasn't in the picture yet. So these theorists could oppose science on the one hand versus basically, what we could call the humanities, but basically all other scholarly pursuits. And historians embraced this and said, yeah, this is why history is not a science. It's a different field of knowledge that aims at a different kind of knowledge or truth. And it shouldn't be evaluated based on whether it can come up with, you know, predictive models.
I really like that. And Brian and I talked about before we went on into this discussion about your claim that it's either physics or the rest is history, right? And I have to say, I thought you were bonkers when I first heard you say that. And I'm coming around to it, especially reading Cleland more carefully. I see that much of what we do in the social, I mean, it's not that I haven't seen that what the social sciences do is very different than, you know, the idealized physics experiment. But I think that I wasn't well enough educated about historical methodologies. And I think just having a bit more of a glimpse of it, I really understand what you're saying. But maybe you could just elaborate your point about that, because I'd love to hear it again with a more open mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think it sort of stems from where this conversation began. Although, again, there are many sort of lines of thought that have come up here that I haven't all fully, I don't know enough to fully process. But the, I think it comes down to how you think about causation and causality, that if you think of causation as something that can be described in the abstract, it's almost like when I spoke about myth, like you can think of myths as a kind of fallen form of history, that they're just sort of a distorted or incorrect description of what happened in the past, and that they need to be debunked by real facts about the past. Or you can think of myth as something that eternally recurs in an eternal present, right? And that any given myth is sort of always happening in a constant present. That is how I think of physical science, that in a sense, physical science is trying to drill down to the underlying structures of cause and effect that are always present and that are always unfolding in every event, everywhere, all the time. Whereas you can reason and describe events in the world as time bound, right? And in a way, you could say history is the opposite extreme in that way, right? Maybe we can think of it as sort of two poles, physics on one end and history on the other, and that we sort of, different disciplines are kind of placing themselves or intercombining these two different ways of reasoning. So if you think of physics as being about the eternal present and just ultimately trying to sort of uncover the structure of events as the world behaves in a sort of eternal present tense, history is trying to place events in a time-bounded way and to show how actions and events take place under fundamentally different conditions because of when and where they happen in time, right? So saying, you know, it's why, you know, we care about dates, you know, and I am always in favor of dates because they place events in relations of causation in time. So,
yes. Mm-hmm. You
know. So, Brian, I wanted to ask you, so thank you, Sam, for that clarification. And I have many other follow-up questions that could come from complexity science and thinking about physics and the time's arrow. But what I wanted to ask Brian is, from this kind of summary of history and physics, How do you think of where Buddhist conceptions of time fit in here? Where are they on, if these are two kind of polarities, sort of, or at least tensions?
Yeah, it's a tough one.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, dependent origination is supposed to happen so fast that you kind of only become aware of the effects after one of these things has happened. But, you know, after a cycle has already taken place. And so you're kind of always forced into this historical mode where you're inferring backwards to try and figure out exactly what's happened. I'm not sure where it would fall in that spectrum, but I have thought that, you know, this reverse order dependent origination where you try to infer the causes does have a relationship to history or historicizing, and it tends to complicate things, right? You like the more I'd be interested to hear Sam's view on this, but it's almost like the more you know, the harder it gets to kind of come up with a general law or something like that. Whereas, you know, maybe on this spectrum, physics is simplifying, right? It's kind of saying it's going for these general laws, and you might get a lot of statistical noise, but you just kind of ignore that, and that's not important to the endeavor. Whereas historicizing, or you know, there's always a lot more going on than we can kind of take in, and so. I don't know. I have thought about it as historicizing. I'm not sure, as in the Buddhist move of like deconstruction. In a way, it's deconstruction, right?
Yes.
It's like, here's the self. How did the self come to be? And in a way, I suppose not all history is like that, but that's quite common in history. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, what I was thinking is that I totally understand the tension there, because it is like history in that there is, to some degree, a narrative that we are uncovering and watching and trying to piece or take apart to some degree, or at least question or examine, investigate in this kind of curious way, that narrative. But it also may be, if you have practiced long enough, is almost a stance against narrativity, against story. Against, or at least the perception of understanding the extent to which it is constructed, and by that nature is not the
it tends to undermine
itself. Yeah, stories, exactly, right. Exactly.
Actually, I wanted to ask Sam something that's kind of related to this, which is just the question of, like, does history itself oscillate in terms of grand narratives versus like specific stories? I guess I'm thinking of, like, these are people that I mostly haven't read, but like thinking about Gibbon as like this kind of simplifying, you know, well, I don't know whether he's simplifying, but, you know, there's this kind of stages or something. And then the Annales school, or like these ideas of where you're getting really into the fine detail of small periods. I don't know. Is that something that you observe, or?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's always this push and pull back and forth between constructing the grand narrative in the multi-volume work, where I, you know, and Fall of the Roman Empire is sort of the great paradigmatic classic of this, right? I'm going to give you the reason, the explanation of why this big event happened, and determine what the underlying forces were. And then, you know, over the next 100 years or so, 36 other scholars come along and pick it apart and find the weaknesses and find the exceptions, the variations, until the narrative falls apart. And maybe some brave soul comes along and tries to put forward another one. This cycle is going on all the time. And the funny thing about historians is, like, they don't, there's not a lot of higher order grappling with, like, what that means, what the implications are of, like, so what exactly are we trying to accomplish here? And in a way, you could say postmodernism and poststructuralism in part are a sort of response saying, let's stop doing that. Like, that shouldn't be our goal anymore. We shouldn't be trying to be Edward Gibbon, which is fair enough, but it leaves the question of then, well, what are we trying to do?
Yeah.
So what is the point of all this? There isn't really a ready answer to that either. So it all, I think if you were to look at debates in historical seminars and colloquiums, you would see a lot of people arguing over this question without realizing it, without really consciously acknowledging that that's the kind of problem that they're grappling with and enacting over and over again. But it's all in a very kind of blind way. So, you know, history in this way is a pretty unself-conscious field, you know, and people can kind of fall back on sort of glib answers to these epistemological questions, and then stumble into the same arguments over and over. But I think you'll also hear the phrase overdetermined a lot, which in a way is funny because it's like, once you've said it enough times, can't we just kind of collectively acknowledge that this is a common situation, you know, that things don't have one cause. Like, there are many, you know, it's like there's no one reason why Brian Cam came into the world. There was a whole series of conditions that had to be in place. And there are differences between necessary conditions and sufficient causes. And it's funny, I was just thinking about all of this again because I've been thinking about, I'd really like to do a series on the beginnings of World War One, which is probably the other, you know, alongside, now alongside Fall of the Roman Empire, it's the other sort of how to ruin your life as a historian topic, right? Or how to make your career as a historian, right? But then be destroyed by the next generation is why did World War One happen? And there's a lot of confusion. You know, there's not a lot of clarity. People don't distinguish between necessary conditions and sufficient causes. People don't explore what counterfactuals they have in mind and why. You know, and my position personally is that if you make any claim about causation, you're then necessarily implying a counterfactual claim. If you say X caused Y, you're necessarily implying without X, there would be no Y.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And historians just don't even, historians argue about counterfactuals all day and don't even acknowledge that.
This is a really important insight, actually. And it's one that the Buddha talks about. So this is like what's understood to be the underlying basis of this thing we keep mentioning, which is called dependent origination. And the simplest form of this is basically, if this arises, that arises. So if this ceases, that ceases. And apparently this is repeated like hundreds and hundreds of times throughout the suttas. So like he's always drawing attention to precisely what you've just said, this kind of distinction or this idea that, you know, if you're making the claim that the forward causal claim, then you're also making the claim that, you know, if A didn't happen, then B wouldn't have happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what I think, you know, history is not the only discipline that doesn't have a very good grasp of meta, their own field and their own patterns of investigation or debates and so on. Psychology is the same, and which is why we do ideally need philosophy to give us some sense of the ways that we can look at our own disciplines and across disciplines and think about what we're doing, what kind of inquiry we're doing, and the why is really important. It's fascinating to me that you and Brian are talking about to some degree the same process, but he, in thinking about the Buddhist dependent origination practice, is talking about this well, fundamentally at first, individual process of looking at causation in one's own experience and seeing it for the immediate and multi-causality that it is, and the degree to which our narratives constrain. And you, Sam, at a historical level, are saying almost the same thing, that we as historians make up stories, then we deconstruct each other's stories, make up new ones. They're really interesting, but what's the actual point of it all? But the exercise of it is the important thing to me. My listening to you both and thinking at these very different levels, there is a practice here that's really important to investigate. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but I think there's something in there.
It does. And I mean, it's also fascinating just to think about if there is this kind of spectrum. You know, we talked about nomothetic and ideographic. I don't know if I'm saying those correctly, but in what you were just saying, Sam, you know, you could think of Gibbon as being on the nomothetic side, whereas, you know, the people coming up against him with all these individual details are, you know, like it's like a smaller pendulum swing, even if history as a whole is on the ideographic side, that it, you know, it has these two poles within it as well. One that wants to make laws of history or something like that, and the other that wants to tear them down, you know?
Well, I see the distinction a bit differently. I think that what Gibbon was doing was ideographic. You know, he was taking a specific historical transformation and trying to say, here are the conditions that were in place that made this happen, right? I think he was not trying, in my understanding, he was not trying to put forward a sort of general theory of how do empires work, right? Or why do empires rise or fall? It's more other people who often want that. Like, there's a great demand for that kind of, those sort of truths, right, to come from history. But historians usually resist that, right? Because it's almost like instinctive. That's not what we do, right?
Right.
And if historians do that, it makes them a bit suspect, right?
Yes. So it's people like Isaac Asimov who are taking Gibbon and trying to make a general point.
Yeah. You know, and there are theoretical points. I mean, there are Hegelian histories and Marxist histories, which are sort of a variation on Hegelian. And they do try to sort of make laws, right? Here's a lot of what you will see is historians of those sort of particular theoretical schools trying to say, this is the law of how history works, and then everyone else tearing it apart, right? So in that sense, yeah, there is this kind of classic, I think, nomothetic versus ideographic tension in history. But in a way, it's a different tension, right? It's a different dialectic. But what was I thinking just about empires? But I mean, the point that Isabella made, I think, a few minutes ago was something I also was thinking about recently when I was trying to work out this paper for Yale, where the more facts you have at your disposal, the more that compounds and multiplies the possible interpretations, right? And having a great wealth of facts doesn't mean that those are going to resolve into one correct narrative, right? In a sense, it's like the more, I think of it almost like we were talking about sort of branching off, looking into the forward and backward in time and seeing the branches of events. It's like the garden of forking paths, right? It's like
Borges, yeah.
Yeah, it's like the greater, the broader view you have over this garden of forking paths, the more different pathways there could be through that garden, if this metaphor is still working.
Yeah, and I would argue from a cognitive science perspective, the more disparate the data, the more chaotic it feels, the more likely we are to rely on obviousnesses, the more likely we need these kind of heuristics or, oh yeah, that's just to simplify this, we can just say generally that dot, dot, dot. And so we end up actually potentially generalizing because we can't deal with such complex, diverse, different types of data. And our narrative-making mind has to simplify in a way that is essentially putting aside a whole lot of data.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and we should talk at some point, you know, we've kind of mentioned last time about issues of depression, anxiety as being these kind of deepening paths. I would love at some point to talk about myelination and also just, you know, the fact that when you do these kind of pattern recognitions and you use a concept, the concept kind of becomes more ingrained each time. You know, it becomes easier to recognize that pattern in the future. And so there are, you know, like, obviously there's a benefit to that, which is that it requires less effort. You know, if we have, you know, I was talking to Nassos this weekend about if we have a causal understanding of how a light switch works and we just go up and use it, then that's totally adaptive and it reduces the amount of energy, you know, like effort required to, you know, get light in the room. But it's only when, you know, the light doesn't come on that this extremely basic understanding requires some kind of inspection, right? And so, and in this case, it's obvious that it does, but in other cases where concepts cease to serve, it may not be so black and white, I guess, right?
Yeah, and I wonder, we don't have time, I think, to get into myelination, but I think that and phase transition, so transition periods and the idea that there are more degrees of freedom, more areas to start thinking about new interpretations at certain periods of either history or certain paradigm shift times in science or in ontogeny, there are certain developmental periods where we are more likely to be open to new concepts and develop new ways of thinking and feeling and behaving and so on. So I think these principles cross really interestingly from all the way from, you know, ontogeny to phylogeny and everything in between in terms of scientific practices as well.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you both so much for coming. This is amazing, an amazing conversation. And I would love to continue sometime. So maybe we can do a little bit more planning and get Sam along and,
and
do this
great.
Again soon.
I kind of like the idea of a psychologist, a historian, and a philosopher chatting about one concept or something together.
Yeah, yeah, thanks. I was glad. I just happened to see the note on Twitter. So I came home and joined in when I could. Thanks. This was a very good conversation.
Thanks, Sam. Great awesome. To hear from both of you. And
yeah.
Until next time.
Until next time.
This is Brian Cam, and you've been listening to Clear Story. Since you've listened to the end of this episode, you're exactly the kind of person that I would love to hear from. So please visit briancam.com, where you can find links to my social media and other ways to contact me. If you would like to receive infrequent updates about my work, please subscribe at briancam.substack.com. If you're interested in supporting my work, please visit patreon.com/briancam, where I post everything that I'm working on. Both of those links are in the show notes, and I look forward to hearing from you.